Okay, well, if anyone's come to this talk expecting swing analysis, ballot box by ballot box, electoral analysis, maiden speeches, private members' bills, well, you're in the wrong place, because actually this talk is a wild ride encompassing sedition, mutiny, public brawling, and even attempted murder. And for those of you from the more sedate southern states, prepare yourselves, because this talk is all about Queensland.
Be the Queensland! Yeah.
Exclusive parochialism, comrades.
Because it was in the red north of Queensland that Fred Patterson got elected to the Queensland State Parliament for the seat of Bowen in 1944. And as a measure of the radicalisation in Queensland at the time, the North Queensland mining town of Scottsville, the Conservative Party failed to win a single vote in the entire town. And in Collinsville, they managed to win just 14 votes out of 900. All the rest of the votes from these communities going to either Fred Patterson or his Labor rival. And all these electoral results are a far cry from the image that we have of Queensland today, which, and indeed for that matter, the entire Australian working class. Queensland, much more associated with obnoxious pests such as cane toads, Pauline Hanson, Joe Bjorke-Peterson, than it is with working class radicalisation that we're going to be talking about today. But the history of Queensland in the 1930s and 40s shows two very important things for revolutionaries today. The first is just the basic fact that there have been radical struggles in Australia, that Australia is not just a hopelessly conservative, complacent place. And secondly, that self-proclaimed revolutionaries can win support amongst the working class. Sure, we've all had the experience at a workers' rally of sort of being snickered at by workers like you and your friend with your magazine, talking about workers' power. But actually, the experience of the Communist Party in North Queensland shows it is possible for radical organisations to win a mass following, provided, by intervening in political issues, in struggles, and doing the kinds of things that this talk is going to be going over. And it's really up to organisations like Socialist Alternative to keep this history alive. You can be pretty sure that the ins and outs of how a communist could win an election to the Queensland State Parliament is not going to be appearing on school syllabuses anytime soon. It's up to people who think this history matters because we want to change the world today to keep it alive, to learn from it and build on it. So the focus of the talk today is going to be on how the relatively radical for the times Communist Party was able to win the support that it did in North Queensland. But it's important to remember with any discussion of the Communist Party that from the late 1920s onwards, it was, as with Communist parties all over the world, increasingly coming under the influence of Stalin. And Stalin, of course, the Russian dictator who came to power as a result of the defeat of the 1917 revolution. But I think despite the growing influence of Stalinism, the vast majority of Communist Party members who organised and carried out the work that I'm going to be talking about today during this period were motivated in their activities primarily, not by anything to do with Stalin, but by a genuine desire to get rid of capitalism and to fight for a world of equality that's, better and fairer than what we get under capitalism. And, this is, in the main, what they saw themselves as committing their life to and organising around. And as such, the Communist Party during this period was characterised by, predominantly working class membership, and was characterised by their pursuit of a more radical line than the Australian Labor Party in political issues and disputes of the day, and by a consistent argument for militancy in workplaces and for working class solidarity and opposing racism wherever it came up. So unlike later periods for the Communist Party when the membership was became much more middle class, the period we're looking at today was one where the membership was predominantly working class and the Communist Party was characterised by militancy, by its radicalism. So I'm going to start with a brief outline of Fred Patterson's life and the political events and upheavals that it spanned. So he was born in 1897 in Gladstone in Queensland to a poor farming family, and he won scholarships to Brisbane Grammar, University of Queensland, and Cambridge University as a Rhodes Scholar. He was politicised largely through his involvement in World War I, which he volunteered to fight in 1918, only to find himself when he arrived in France assigned to a platoon where the soldiers there had been on strike for some time over better food, demanding better food and better conditions. And he immediately became part of this rebellion, which went on to success. Following the war, his experience of poverty and rebellion in Ireland during the 1920s further politicised him, and on his return to Australia, he pretty much immediately joined the Communist Party. In 1923, he began training to become a lawyer, and despite an absolutely overwhelming level of establishment conspiracy to ensure he could not be admitted into the legal fraternity, including a bogus charge of sedition, he eventually was admitted in 1931. But rather than use this qualification to have a nice, comfortable life for himself or, you know, a whiz-bang new iPod, Fred used his legal skills to defend the unemployed, workers subject to racist harassment, and to challenge government repression of political dissent and police brutality. And Queensland being the capital, Australian capital of police brutality, he was never short of cases to take up. But he never or barely ever received any payment for this work, and so he had a life largely lived in poverty. But he also was able, through this work, to win the title of People's Champion and was a hero to the unemployed, downtrodden and oppressed of North Queensland. And I think there's no doubt which would have meant more to Fred Patterson. During his legal career, Fred was continually harassed by the legal establishment and the government. He had to deal with the solicitor's boycott of solicitors in Brisbane, refusing to refer him work, numerous attempts to have him disbarred, bans on him speaking in public, and eventually an attempt on his life at the hands of the Queensland Police Force. But rather than let all this adversity cower him, this simply fueled Fred's desire to fight for a better world. And he took part, you know, both while he was in and outside of Parliament, took part or supported strikes by sugar workers, campaigned against racism towards Italian workers, supported anti-fascist struggles, and opposed the persecution of the unemployed. And as a result of these activities, was elected to the Townsville Council in 1939. While on the Townsville Council, he was largely responsible for this, providing affordable stoves for workers in Townsville, establishing public libraries, public swimming pool, and even a public iceworks when the military took over the existing Townsville iceworks during the Second World War. After this, in 1944, and he was elected to the Queensland State Parliament and again in 1947. During his time in Parliament, he toured around holding meetings with workers about what was going on in Parliament, supported strikes and campaigns outside of Parliament and usually against the Parliament. But Fred Patterson didn't win the election in 1944 on the basis of his personal popularity alone. His victory was in large part due to his involvement in the Australian Communist Party and being the main or most high-profile figure in the Australian Communist Party in Queensland. And the Communist Party, through the activities of its hundreds of members in Queensland, had managed to win a significant level of support in North Queensland amongst the working class. So I'm going to now look at some of the struggles and issues that the Communist Party intervened around or involved itself in, and through doing so was able to build up this this level of support. So starting with defending the unemployed during the Depression, because unemployment in Australia during the Depression that began in 1929 reached over 30%. Workers in Sydney and Melbourne found themselves homeless, and workers even died of starvation in capital cities. And Queensland was no exception to this trend. Unemployment in Queensland reached over 30% in 1931. And more than that, a lot of the unemployed from around the rest of the country migrated to Queensland because, you know, it's easier to be homeless in the Sunshine State than in freezing cold Melbourne. And the seasonal work meant that there was a few more opportunities for the unemployed. But in Queensland, as in everywhere else in Australia, the unemployed nevertheless faced harassment, persecution, and ongoing hardship. And little support was forthcoming for the unemployed from the supposed charitable organisations and the organised labour movement. The churches refused to let their halls be made available for sheltering the unemployed. And in one case in Queensland, an Italian communist worker put up 10 unemployed workers in their house and who lived next door to the Australian Workers Union headquarters, begged the Australian Workers Union to allow them to use their toilets for the 9 people staying at his house, and they refused. And there's many stories like that of how, such a small amount of, support came from the kind of official organisations in society. But so in this context, it was the Communist Party that did show sympathy, provided support, and tried to organise the working class victims of the capitalist system's worst ever crisis. So they did things like take up collections in workplaces, organised places for the unemployed to stay, and organised for their own members to put up as many of the unemployed as they could. The Communist Party also organised the unemployed workers' movement, which held public meetings and campaigned for the rights of the unemployed. And the success of this movement was absolutely incredible, with it growing to 68,000 members nationally by 1934. And added to this, the Communist Party's arguments about the brutality of the capitalist system, its inability and unwillingness to provide for people's most basic needs, and the role of the state as a supporter of capitalist order was plain for all to see. So this also attracted a new layer of people to the Communist Party as well. And one incident that Fred himself was involved in during this period, I think, highlights the way in which the Communist Party was prepared to take a stand. And this was an incident that occurred in Cairns, Cairns being at the end of a railway line, so a place where a lot of the unemployed found themselves. And they set up a camp at Parramatta, the showgrounds in Parramatta Park in Cairns. And they raised the Communist Party flag over the stand and, had a big little community living in the showgrounds. And in July 1932, they were descended on by hundreds of Cairns' decent citizens, urged on by the local mayor, the local newspapers, and the Queensland Police Force, urged on to attack the unemployed that were camping there, armed with baseball bats, farm machinery, God knows what. And so they basically carried out a public bashing of the unemployed, seriously injuring 100 people. But who was charged after this this bashing? Mostly unemployed workers. And Fred Patterson played a prominent role successfully defending 3 of the unemployed charged with assaulting police. This bashing received that endorsement or the tacit support of the Queensland state government, along with every sort of establishment figure. So the second issue in which the Communist Party intervened around and was able to win support was defending the Italian population in North Queensland against government repression and discrimination. Because in Queensland at this time had the largest Italian migrant population of any state. In Ingham, the sugar-growing town, Italian workers made up 83% of the population. And many of these Italian workers had left Italy to escape Mussolini's repressive fascist regime. And as such, it was in North Queensland, in a town called Halifax, where the first Australian anti-fascist march was held in 1925. And so the Italian population, as with other groups of migrants that make up the Australian working class, that characterise the Australian working class, brought with them a lot of the political traditions and ideas that that they'd been a part of, immersed in Europe and elsewhere. And they brought these ideas and shared them with workers that they were working alongside in Australia and used them as weapons in the fight for workers' rights here. And this, of course, represented a fairly serious threat for the Australian government, who did not want to see a more politicised or more combative working class. And so the Australian government despite its supposed opposition to fascism and commitment to democracy, was no friend to these anti-fascist Italian migrants. It cooperated fully with the fascist government representatives in Australia in their efforts to repress and intimidate the Italian migrants, even during the period in which it was at war with Mussolini's Italy. So the kinds of things the government did was delay the naturalisation of anti-fascists so that they could always hold the threat of deportation over them, raided their clubs, banned their anti-fascist newspapers, and supplied their names to the Italian authorities in order that their families in Italy could be threatened and harassed. Because for the Australian government, a rebellious working class was a much bigger threat even than their imperialist enemies. But anti-fascist Italian workers were not coward and nevertheless continued to organise, agitate, put out their papers legally and illegally and hold meetings and demonstrations. And one such demonstration that Fred Patterson himself was involved in occurred in 1931 when the Italian the representative of the Australian the Italian government in Australia was going on a national tour. And he was some kind of count. And there was a public reception held for him in Ingham, the sugar town, where Italian workers invaded his reception, ripped off his fascist badge, and forced the band to play the Internationale, Italian national anthem. Of course, all these men found themselves fairly promptly in court, and it was Fred Patterson who defended them. And successfully defended them, but probably less to do with his legal panache and more to do with was able to get them off more to do with the fact that the jury was made up of waterside workers who had very little sympathy for the count and much more sympathy for the anti-fascist workers. But the case won an enormous amount of support for Fred Patterson and he became a real hero amongst the Italian working class in North Queensland. And connected with this anti-fascist activity was, which I don't have time to go into, was the campaign to support the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War, at which Fred was part of speaking at the send-off for workers and a delegation of nurses organised by the Communist Party and the Italian anti-fascist groups to go off and fight and help in the Spanish Civil War. So Fred was a part of, you know, supporting that campaign, raising money and rallying people to go and help. The second issue to that won the Communist Party support and solidarity from the Italian working class in North Queensland was their willingness to take a stand against racism, because racism was actively campaigned for and stoked by the farmers and bosses in North Queensland in an attempt to undermine conditions and solidarity amongst sugar workers, predominantly sugar workers. So, and again, the leadership of the official labour movement, which in Queensland is dominated by the Australian Workers' Union, was absolutely cooperated in this process. In June 1930, the AWU, along with the Australian Sugar Producers Association, the Queensland and the Queensland Cane Growers Council, bosses' organisations, signed an agreement to restrict migrant labour on the sugar fields. They signed an agreement that required that 75% of workers on the cane fields be British subjects, and this policy was known as British preference. Obviously a racist policy against the Italian workers. But this agreement provided an opening for an alliance between anti-fascist Italian workers and the Communist Party, gave them something to fight against together. And so fairly shortly after this agreement was reached, the Foreign Cutters Defence Organisation was formed in Innisfail and immediately hired Fred, you know, a notable communist, to challenge the agreement legally. But the Communist Party also put out pamphlets and posters and published their newspaper in Italian and Greek to try and, you know, connect up the workers and bridge the language divide. And while this was one of the few legal challenges that wasn't successful for Fred, nevertheless outlined how it helped, you know, the role it played in winning more workers to an anti-racist position. Because he says, under the leadership of the Communist Party in North Queensland, we were able to, first of all, enlighten a lot of those who supported British preference for Labour, and even good militants we had to win over, because some of them had been poisoned by this racial bigotry or national bigotry. The result was that finally British preference was defeated as an official policy of the Cane Growers Association. So because they had the campaign, eventually, you know, the policy was done away with. But more importantly, the Communist Party was able to win more workers to an anti-racist position, which didn't, you know, as he said, even good militants didn't necessarily come naturally, or people couldn't always at first see the point of opposing the policy. But because the Communist Party, and, you know, this is no surprise, given the leadership of the official labour movement was part of forging the policy, but because the Communist Party existed and was there, could make arguments and organise the more class-conscious layer of sugar workers, they were effectively able to win over more workers to an anti-fascist point of view, which is, you know, a very practical example of, you know, why we argue for revolutionary organisation, why we need to organise a minority, not because they're better than everyone else, but in order to win over and influence the rest of the working class. And this is a good example of how the Communist Party was able to do this around the question of British preference. The Communist Party also led the campaign for civil liberties and against the internment of Italians during World War II, which was, again, you know, it has huge parallels with the War on Terror, the attack on civil liberties during World War II, the, basically arrest and taking away of Italian workers. And, of course, you know, the Australian government being what it is, it was mainly anti-fascist Italian workers that found themselves interned and supporters of the Italian regime much less likely to be. And it was the Communist Party that led the campaign against this and tried to support the families of the Italian workers left behind. But I don't have time to go into that. But I'm going to move on to one of the best examples of how the Communist Party's activities helped to unite white workers and migrant workers, which came with the Wills disease strike in 1935. This was an extremely important strike for the Communist Party in North Queensland. And Wills disease, for people who don't know, a deadly epidemic of it broke out in the early 30s in Queensland. In 1934, 36 cases were diagnosed in a month, two proving fatal, and in August, 80 cases were diagnosed in 1 month. And Wills disease is a disease that primarily affects cane cutters. It's caused by rats living in the cane fields that carry around a bacteria, and when workers get cut with infected cane, they develop this disease. And it's got quite a high fatality rate, and deaths from the disease are pretty horrible. It involves like the disintegration and rupturing of kidneys, bowel, spleen, and lungs. So cane cutters lived in constant fear of contracting this disease. So it sounds pretty horrible, but surprise, surprise, a relatively simple solution existed to prevent it, and this involved burning the cane before harvesting, which kills the disease and gets rid of the rats that spread it. However, the catch being that it also reduces the yield of sugar that can be obtained from the cane and thus affects the profits of the cane growers. And as such, they campaigned staunchly against the practice with the support of, guess who, the Australian Workers Union as well. And with their allies in the ALP state government. And it was during this strike that the Australian Workers' Union earned the title of Australia's worst union amongst workers in North Queensland. And so the campaign to have cane burnt before harvesting, in this campaign, the workers and the Communist Party had to take on this quite threatening array of establishment forces. Nevertheless, the strike began July 1935 in Marillion and quickly spread to Tully, Goondi, no one's probably heard of any of these places, but a few other towns in North Queensland. So by August of 1935, 2,000 cane cutters were on strike, and their actions immobilised the mills and, you know, had a flow-on effect to other parts of the industry, basically meaning 4,000 workers were not working. Strike committees were established in every town, and a coordinating committee to coordinate between them and organise a number of mass meetings in Innisfail was set up. And at one of these meetings in Innisfail, which basically became demonstrations because there was no hall in which all the workers could fit into, so they basically had to be held out on the streets, workers painted this banner, which was like a work of art of rats running down the street, and each rat had the face of, you know, one of the cane growers, Australian Workers Union officials, the Queensland State Labor Government, and the slogan being "War on All Rats," which was a comment on the role of these forces in the dispute as, you know, traitors to the workers, and also, you know, spreaders of the disease, obviously. But this banner, which was you know, something to behold, unfortunately stolen and destroyed by the Queensland police, so lost to the history of the workers' movement, but nevertheless attempts to reproduce it have been made. But the role that the Australian Workers Union played during the strike was to try to stop it happening at all. So they tried to force or channel the dispute into secret ballots. They tried to, you know, force workers to hold secret ballots before actually having the strike. But this didn't really work out because no one would participate in them. I think maybe 30 workers voted against the strike, but it was duly ignored. And when this failed, this strategy by the AWU leaders failed, they simply tried to starve the workers out of strike and refused to provide any relief or play any part in collecting relief for the workers. The Labor state government, desperate to maintain profitability in the sugar industry, also refused to provide any relief for the workers. But where these forces let the working class down or actively conspired against them, the Communist Party and the militant minority movement that organised within the unions filled the breach. It tirelessly raised money for the strike, set up communal kitchens, provided accommodation for strikers, organised pickets, made arguments and provided encouragement to keep up morale. Hundreds of pounds was donated by workers in other Communist Party strongholds, such as the mining towns of Collinsville and Scottsville that I mentioned earlier. And these two towns were in a seemingly endless war over who could raise the most money, provide the most solidarity for working class causes around Queensland. The strike also brought to the fore and won the Communist Party a significant level of support amongst women, the wives of sugar workers and whatever else, which I don't have time to go into, but which is documented in the communist writer Jean Devaney's novel Sugar Heaven. And while the Wheels Disease strike was not entirely successful, the strike did force the Arbitration Commission to grant several burning orders, so it actually meant that in some places the sugar cane was burnt before harvesting, and this, you know, obviously would have slowed down the spread of the disease. But also it laid the basis for later on the bosses backing down, and, you know, without this strike there wouldn't have been the burning and rat poisoning that sort of went on following, you know, despite the defeat in the late 30s. And also despite the defeat, so it wasn't, you know, just for nothing, but also the Communist Party, by taking part in the strike, by demonstrating in practice that the Australian Labor Party, with its commitment to capitalism, could never be a consistent ally of rank-and-file workers, won an enormous amount of support. And, you know, was able to convince a whole layer of workers in North Queensland about the need for a radical alternative. So as a result of these, are just, so I've talked about the Communist Party supporting unemployed workers in the Depression, taking a stand against racism and taking part in the strikes of sugar workers against Wheels disease, which are just a few of the examples of the kinds of things the Communist Party did to win support. But a sort of reflection of how, you know, these activities paid off for the Communist Party came with when the Communist Party was banned in 1940 as a result of its support, its opposition to World War II. So, unfortunately, the Communist Party's opposition to World War II was not on a principled basis and vanished overnight when Russia entered the war. But nevertheless, the fact that they opposed, you know, this important government policy earned them prescription in 1940. But for a lot of workers in North Queensland, it was the Communist Party that had taken on their enemies. It was the Communist Party that had stood up to the right-wing AWU leadership. It was the Communist Party that had, you know, supported strikes, taken a stand against racism. And all this meant that the absolute anti-communist hysteria coming from the state government was quite significantly undermined. So even though the Communist Party's opposition to World War II was not a particularly popular policy that they had, nevertheless, they managed to mobilise, you know, a huge amount of working class support in North Queensland against the ban. And this involved, you know, raising money to oppose the ban, holding meetings, and finding new and interesting ways to get around the ban. So in Townsville, the Communist Party had to hold meetings on surfboards out in the ocean where the police couldn't hear what was going on. So, you know, take your life in your hands in Queensland. Sharks, box jellyfish could go on. Yeah. but these were less frightening than the police at the time. And they also held meetings in football stands during football matches where, you know, the yelling was so loud that the police couldn't hear what was going on there either. And so, yeah, like the Communist Party was able to mobilise a significant level of support against the ban. And, of course, you know, it was during the Second World War that Fred Patterson actually was able to win the election, the first election and only election the Communist Party ever won. But I think one of the things that Fred Patterson is most known for occurred while he was actually a Member of Parliament, and that was his attempted murder during the 1948 Queensland Railway strike. In late 1947, Queensland Rail Unions basically launched a campaign for a pay rise and improved penalty rates. And the Queensland State Government, led by Ned Hanlon, who was himself a former railway worker, fought tooth and nail to oppose the strike. Mass meetings were held across the state by railway workers, all of which voted for a strike in February 1948. The strike involved 3,000 workers and was led and successfully led predominantly by the Communist Party. But for the government, this was a strike that had to be defeated for a number of reasons I don't have time to go into. The state government launched a massive propaganda campaign against the railway workers, deriding it as a communist plot. You know, the Courier Mail had a headline saying, "Red grip on rail strike tightens." And Hanlon, the Premier of Queensland, took to the airwaves almost in tears to denounce the red menace that was threatening civil war in Queensland. And the state government's attack on the strikers was helped by the federal Labor government, who also did their part by declaring strikers ineligible for Commonwealth social security benefits. In Parliament House, Fred was the only Member of Parliament who defended the strike. When he famously said of it, "There comes a time in the life of every man when he comes up against what he considers to be an injustice so grave that he cannot tolerate it, and he begins to kick. If he is in an organisation, he kicks in an organised way," which was pretty much what happened during the railway strike. So Fred Patterson did picket duty every morning and provided legal advice for the workers on strike. The notorious Queensland Move On laws was one of the main things that the workers were up against. And Fred frustrated the Queensland police and state government by advising workers that to move on, you only had to move on a couple of metres and you were at liberty to come back and restart the picket. So this led to the Queensland state government introducing special laws that the Premier called Fred Patterson laws to get around this legal advice. And this wasn't, you know, Fred was not tolerated for long. While observing a march in support of the strike from the footpath, don't forget, on St. Patrick's Day in 1948, he was bashed in the back of the head by a plainclothes detective. And he was very nearly killed and never entirely recovered from his injuries. And he wasn't the only one to be bashed on that day, but every other worker who was bashed by the police on that day was a communist, which goes some way to demonstrating the effectiveness of the Communist Party in making this strike a success. So whether or not the bashing was on the order was on orders from the Labor government, they nevertheless turned an approving blind eye to the affair, if that's possible. The Premier refused an inquiry into the bashing, made fun of the one member of Parliament who asked a question about what went on, and pretty much every respectable figure lined up to say nothing about the bashing, including future Governor General Bill Hayden, who only admitted in his memoirs 50 years later that he'd heard from the detective's mouth that the attack had been unprovoked, whereas the government's defence was Fred Patterson had been causing trouble. But in a reflection of Fred's popularity, days after the bashing, workers all across the country took to the streets in outrage. In Townsville, there was large, angry street demonstrations. In Bowen, in Collinsville, again, indignant mass meetings. New South Wales coal miners stopped work for 24 hours. In Darwin, there was a one-day strike, and even the ACTU felt moved to condemn the bashing. But this didn't put off the ALP's campaign against Fred. In time for the following state election, the government gerrymandered or redrew the boundaries of Fred's electorate so as to make it unwinnable, and it was even more unwinnable because he was still recovering from the injuries sustained from state government. I think this shows that so much for those who say they're committed to pursuing change through the official channels because it's more democratic and less violent than what a revolution could be. Yeah. Actually, the ALP was prepared to stoop to this level of thuggery and dirty tricks to bring down one lone communist MP. And if they're willing to nearly kill one lone communist MP, you can imagine what they're capable of when they're threatened with working class struggle or revolution or a serious challenge to their government. I think it shows up the utter hypocrisy of the Labor Party, who actually want to use the violence of the capitalist system and use any undemocratic manoeuvring they can to wipe out, in this case, their electoral opposition, both through, you know, using the rules against him and using physical violence to try and physically destroy him. Shows up the utter hypocrisy of the Labor Party. But I think why it's important for revolutionaries to know something about the experience of North Queensland at this time is primarily the way in which workers can be drawn towards a radical alternative. Because when the Communist Party of Australia was formed in Sydney in 1920, it was formed at a meeting of 26 people representing not all that many more around the country, and it had very little, if any, influence. But it was able to build up its strength and support through being part of struggles like the ones I've talked about today, arguing for a more militant and uncompromising approach, and through making persistent arguments to those around them about the issues of the day and why the blame has to be laid at the feet of capitalism. And the experience in North Queensland, the fact that the Communist Party was able to have some success in this activity shows that Australian workers are not irredeemably conservative. There's no right-wing gene that somehow gotten stuck in the gene pool of Australia. That actually, you know, the influence of the migrant nature of the Australian working class, it's brought political traditions and ideas. It means that it's more combative, and that when an alternative exists to the, you know, existing leadership, to the Labor Party and the trade union leaders, that actually workers can be won to it. Obviously a precondition is that this alternative has to exist. And I think that the issues that drove workers to the Communist Party in North Queensland absolutely continue to characterise our society today. You know, bosses putting profits ahead of workers' lives. Well, just as the cane growers didn't want to make the cane fields safe for workers if it came at the expense of their profits, well, you look at the battle that workers suffering under the effects of asbestos face against the James Hardie bosses, or indeed, you know, the peril that construction workers face on building sites. These things go on today. And just as the Italian population was persecuted due to their radicalism and because the government was at war with Italy, you know, so today the Muslims feel the brunt of government repression, persecution, get randomly imprisoned and subject to vile levels of racism as part of the Australian government's war today on the Middle East. So these are issues not unique to the 1930s and 40s, but are enduring features of the capitalist system that will continue to inspire rebellion and revolt until the system itself is destroyed. But the need for an organisation committed to leading struggles of workers and the oppressed for their rights is therefore just as urgent, if not more, today as it was then. And while we're clearly starting from a smaller base today than the Communist Party built up in North Queensland, we're fortunate, or we have an advantage, in that we're not weighed down with the politics that looked to Russia that ultimately undermined the Communist Party's support in Queensland. So there's no reason why today a genuinely revolutionary organisation can't be built amongst the Australian working class in the future. But we need to be laying the basis for such an organisation today by committing ourselves to revolutionary politics and by making a contribution towards laying the basis for such an organisation today.